appreciate Steve filling in at the last minute. I can remember when I was only in the church a little while, Joe Momgren saying to me, you got to be flexible. And that means perhaps change up at the last minute. So we are going to Luke chapter 13. And I'm going to read in your hearing verses 22 to 35. Now, Jesus is headed toward Jerusalem, and as he walks along, he enters the villages along the way, and he teaches. And he was passing through from one city and village to another, teaching and proceeding on his way to Jerusalem, and someone said to him, Lord, are there just a few who are being saved? And he said to them, strive to enter through the narrow door. For many, I tell you, will seek to enter and will not be able. Once the head of the house gets up and shuts the door, and you begin to stand outside and knock on the door, saying, Lord, open up to us. Then he will answer and say to you, I do not know where you are from. And then you will begin to say, we ate and drank in your presence, and you taught in our streets. And he will say, I tell you, I do not know where you are from. Depart from me, all you evildoers. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth when you see Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and all the prophets in the kingdom of God, but yourselves being thrown out. And they will come from east and west and from north and south and will recline at the table in the kingdom of God. And behold, some are last who will be first. And some are first who will be last. Just at that time, some Pharisees approached, saying to him, go away, leave here, for Herod wants to kill you. And he said to them, go and tell that fox, behold, I cast out demons and perform cures today and tomorrow, and the third day I reach my goal. Nevertheless, I must journey on today and tomorrow and the next day, for it cannot be that a prophet should perish outside of Jerusalem. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophet and stones those sent to her. How often I wanted to gather your children together, just as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you would not have it. Behold, your house is left to you desolate. And I say to you, you will not see me until the time comes when you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And so we see Jesus proceeding toward Jerusalem, and he's teaching in the various cities and villages as he goes. And the question comes up, are there just a few being saved? And I want you to watch the transition because it's crucial. Because many questions he dealt with, this came from religious issues of the day. Okay, and so if we made a list of religious issues of our day, there are a number of them in the church even now. Things like how do we deal with music? How do we deal with divorced people? How do we deal with homosexual activity? And there's tremendous arguments going on in our church, just as there was issues of the day in that day. And so the scribes would often discuss, or the Pharisees, this very question, how many people would be saved? And it's a general question. And you know what? We're comfortable with general questions. We like general questions, especially if they're about somebody else. And so, you know, we might say, well, this is how the Catholics do things. Or this is what the Jehovah's Witnesses say. Or this is what the Anglican Church likes over in England. And you could talk about that at great lengths. And we have just dealt with the question last time we spoke on this chapter about Pilate, who had killed some Galileans. And Jesus turned that question around and said, do you think those people are any bigger sinners than you? And so the question then is changed from the general question of how many people are going to be saved to a very specific question. What about you? You know, the theoretical is always easier than the practical, because many times when you get into a theoretical argument, it might be impossible to arrive at total consensus. And these questions are good for people who love to argue. But these things touch on people in general, touch on doctrine, might touch on things like last days, eschatology, you know, what's going to happen first, what's going to happen second. These are somewhat comfortable arguments. But the big question for each individual, and I was thinking about that this morning when Little was speaking, is not what do others do, but the question is, what do you do? What will you do with Christ? What will you do with your life? And those two questions are intertwined. Christianity and Christ cannot be confined inside the walls of this church. Because if you try to do it, you're going to be a very unhappy person. You're not going to like yourself very much. And so practical questions are generally personal questions. They deal with us. They deal with our future. Who are we? What are we all about? What are we going to do? The first and most important question is, are we saved or not? Are we a disciple? Are we a follower? After we become a follower, then the question becomes, this relationship we're in, where's it taking us? Where are we obliged to go? And as we go, what are we going to do? And so the question of the number of those being saved is a theoretical question, but the reply is not. Jesus tells a questioner, strive to enter by the narrow gate. Many will seek it, will not be able. And so when he says strive to enter by the narrow gate, my old English teacher would have said, the implied subject is you strive to enter by the narrow gate. And you strive rather than coming and asking me if only a few are being saved. Never mind about the few or the many. What about you? Others may not enter, but you strive to enter. And the kingdom of heaven here is likened to a feast. You know, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, the patriarchs are there. And the head of the house gets up and shuts the door. Now, in those days, most people didn't have such a thing as locks and keys. The door was barred from the inside. And when someone got up and barred the door, then no one was going to be coming in. Those outside are going to say, well, Jesus taught in their streets, and they ate and drank with him. They saw him. They knew him. That will not help them, for they will be cast out. And they're defined, if you notice, as evildoers. I don't know where you're from. I don't know you. You don't have a relationship with me. And there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth when they see others going to this great feast, and they can't go. And so there was a lot of feasts at the time. In the Middle East to this day, people like to set forth the notion of abundance. Okay, so if you ever read the book, Seven Pillars of Wisdom by T.E. Lawrence, they had a Bedouin that was giving them a feast, and they got a big plate of rice that they set up on the floor, big plate. Everybody would sit around there, and they would eat with their right hand, because it was insulting to use your left. And they'd take from a common dish, and they'd pour butter over the rice three or four times until some butter ran on the floor. And the idea there was to show the sheik had so much, he could afford to waste some by pouring it on the floor. Abundance. And the feast reflected that. And so we have the idea of a gracious invitation. I want you to come to this feast. And in those days, the invitations were generally double. We'll talk about this again in the future. But a feast took a lot of preparation. They didn't go to Walmart. If they had meat, they killed it that day, made sure it was kosher, and baked lots of bread and gathered grapes or whatever. And so the servant might come weeks ahead of time and say, hey, such and such a day, my master's giving a feast. Will you come? Oh, yes, I'll come. I'll come. But then on the day, usually it would be in the evening, the slave would come around a second time and say, everything is ready. Come around such and such time, and the feast will be there. Well, it was just telling him the exact time. He'd already been invited. He already said he wanted to come. And so I liken this to a window of opportunity that opens and closes. And so now, at the second invitation, person doesn't want to come. Windows. If you're deciding on an education, or if you're offered a job, or if you're thinking about getting married, no opportunity stays open forever. So if you dangle the young lady on the string too long, she might decide that the bird in the hand over here is a better bet. You don't know. And so in the ministry of Christ, the Jewish nation was being invited. But this was the second invitation. Because God said that the scepter shall not depart from his hand until Shiloh comes. So very, very long ago. And again, Moses said, there'll be another prophet like unto me. You better listen to him. And if you don't listen to him, God will require it from your hand. And so the nation had been invited, and they said, sure, we'll come. We want the Messiah. And so he's telling them he's here. He's teaching. He's eating and drinking with the people. But the people, especially the leadership, didn't want to humble themselves and seek the narrow way. You'll hear it today. I don't need this. I'm a good person. Or you'll hear, well, I have my church. Okay? And they tell me if I follow their rules, that everything is good. So they don't want to seek the narrow way. First, they don't want to admit they have to seek the narrow way. And they don't want to spend the effort or the humility to do it. The Jewish leaders consider the nation of Israel the most important nation in the world, and the one and only nation with a relationship with God. In this, they were correct, but by the Babylonian captivity. God showed he had expectations that the nation would obey. Yes, I've given you special status, but you don't have a free ride. There are expectations. He would show grace and he would show mercy to the nation. But his mercy wouldn't last forever. Punishment would eventually come. But the Messiah came first to the Jewish nation. He was promised to the nation. He came out of the nation. And when he sent out the 70, his instructions were, go to the lost sheep of the nation of Israel. Don't go by way of Samaritans. Don't go off to the Gentiles. And Paul put it another way. This is Christ we're preaching, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. Now, Israel had privileges from God, and the nation, and particularly the leadership, was fixed on the law of Moses, but also on the various traditions that they had woven around the law. The religious leaders considered themselves experts in those things. They had no intention of yielding their place to Jesus. Now, all of the churches today also have traditions. If you look at any church, including this one, there are traditions. And you might say, well, why do you do it this way? And the people might reply, well, we like it this way. Okay. Why do you sing the hymns we sing tonight? Well, they're familiar. We like those hymns. Why do you meet when you meet? Why do you do the service order? Well, we like it that way. And there's nothing wrong with that. But what we have to be very careful about is when we say we like it that way, but some of those things could be a stumbling block to a new believer, could be a stumbling block to an unsaved person, could be a stumbling block to someone who's seeking. Because then we are putting tradition a click higher than the command to be disciples and make disciples. And that's wrong. So, because the religious leaders of the day considered themselves experts, instead of marveling at the teaching and the things that Jesus did, they were annoyed, and especially at the signs. Because they could talk themselves into a circle. They could sit on one side of the table and question and sit on the other side of the table and answer. But they couldn't do anything about the signs. And so he was thought to be a rival to the respect that was shown to them. They didn't want to yield their place. So you get pride, you get envy. Those are big issues. Those are issues in the church to this day. Pride and envy. Now, lest you think this is ancient history in Israel, guess what? Three elections, still no government. What's the problem? Two parties, just about neck and neck. But one party says no more special privileges for the Haredi, the ultra-Orthodox. They're not going to tell us who can be married and who can't be married. They're not going to tell us who is really a Jew and who is not a Jew. Conversions can be done by the local rabbi. They're not going to be exempt if they're studying in a yeshiva from military service, because everybody has to serve unless they're physically disabled. And so you have 61 votes as a goal. You got 30-some on this side. You got 30-some on this side. And then you got little parties scattered. But the special privilege and the authority of the ultra-Orthodox is the pebble in his shoe that's keeping a leader from being appointed in Israel. Today. Although their votes are relatively few, but they're in the coalition. And so then the question becomes, what are we going to do? The answer, we'll have another election, see if that can sort it out. That's been done twice now from the first. Still not sorted out. Pride. Desire for power. Okay. Power of the few to make the many bend to their will. You will do what we want. And there's many issues. I don't have time to talk about them. And you probably wouldn't be interested anyway. I'm interested in these things. So I spare you from that. But nonetheless, it's still going on. At the statement that many would come from the east, the west, the north, the south to be at the table. Who are those people? You. How many here expect to be at that table in the kingdom? I assume all of you do. And we read that some who are last will be first, and some are first who will be last. Jews would not eat Gentiles or associate with them. They compared Gentiles to dogs. These are not the lap dogs of today, but they're half wild dogs that lived outside the city gates and fought over the scraps that were thrown in the garbage dump. Half starved, unclean. These are the type of animals who what? Ate up Jezebel as a punishment for her wickedness. Because the prophet said, you're not going to be able to say, here is Jezebel. Because she's going to be like manure on the face of the ground. And it literally came to pass. And so to think or to hear that Gentiles might come into the kingdom of God while Jews might be excluded. This was turning religious thought of the time on its head. This was like crazy. And so sometimes people say, well, listen to what this man says. He got to be crazy. You know, we're sons of Abraham. Everything's for us. That statement would not be accepted. And aside from this, we see some who were highly esteemed would be last in the kingdom of heaven. And some who were not esteemed at all would be first. It's another way of saying some of the Jews who considered themselves very pious might be last, while some Gentiles might be first. And I've seen this in the local church. We had a businessman who wanted to be deacon. Names are withheld to protect the innocent. And his wife went around and campaigned a little for him. And he wanted a certain job. And he said, well, that's a no-brainer. He didn't get that job. He didn't get that responsibility. His attendance at church was spotty. His prayer life was. And every so often he would go in and complain to the pastor about this, that, or something else. kind of a needy congregant. Now, I didn't take anything away from him in his business. He had money. Don't begrudge him his money. But spiritual qualifications are spiritually apprised. And the ability to make money is not on the list in Timothy or Titus. And so we see that the first may be last, and the last may be first. Now, we believe Jesus was in Perea at the time. And we believe this because Perea was ruled by Herod Antipas, who was the son of Herod the Great. Now, Herod Antipas is the one that had John the Baptist put in prison and subsequently had him beheaded. And so he wondered whether this Jesus that he keeps hearing about could be John risen from the dead. And I'm sure that a guilty conscience was working overtime there as he was worrying about this. And so you see some Pharisees coming up to warn Jesus, you better get out of Perea, because Herod might get after you. Herod wants to kill you. Might kill you like he killed John the Baptist. Now, whether they really wanted to warn him or simply wanted him out of Perea and into Judea where they could watch him more closely, I don't know. You know, they might have wanted to accuse him. We know that, as a general rule, they were not his friends. And so look at the response, because no one ever spoke like Jesus. Herod is compared to a fox. Go tell that fox. What do you know about foxes? They're sneaky. They're cunning. They mainly move around in the dark of night. And come morning, there's chickens missing from the chicken house. My grandfather always raised chickens. He never had any good thing to say about foxes. Now he says, you go tell that fox. There's an assumption there. There's an assumption that these Pharisees that come very piously saying, oh, brother Jesus, you better get out of here because Herod might do you harm. Go tell that fox. Well, for them to go tell him, there's got to be a relationship between them. And there's also an implication that they might be coming from Herod or in communication with Herod. It's unlikely that a common person could get in to see Herod. Could you or I get in to see the president? I don't think so. Most likely they'd arrest us at the White House fence. There would be an incident. Now, there's no record that the Pharisees used a relationship with Herod Antipas to try to do anything for John the Baptist. They didn't try to get him out of prison. So when they put on this act like they're concerned, it was clear that their relationship with Herod was probably closer and more congenial than their relationship with Jesus. You go tell that fox. He's performing signs. He's preaching. He's teaching. He's doing the work he was sent to do. But he's headed for Jerusalem. There's a much greater work to be done, and he will reach his goal. Herod will not kill him in Perea. It's his destiny to perish in Jerusalem. This is the city that kills the prophets, stones the ones sent by God. Now, when danger is at hand, typically when the shadow of the hawk comes across the farmyard, the hen will gather her chicks under her wings for safety. It takes a pretty big hawk. Most of them can't carry away a hen. She's too heavy. but they can and will carry away the chicks. And so this is a very graphic image of Jesus wanting to protect the city of Jerusalem. How often I wanted to gather you, like the hen gathers the chicks under her wings, but you wouldn't do it. What Jesus saw was rebellion and unbelief. They didn't believe, and they didn't want to believe. You know, when I've been trying to explain things to people sometimes, and I've been talking to associates about it, I've said they don't want to hear the truth. They prefer to hear a lie. Tell them what they want to hear that's false and foolishness, and they want to hear it. But if you tell them the truth, no. So whether I was explaining a contract or pensions or all sorts of things, you tell them the truth, they don't want to hear it. Common in the human condition. And Jesus was telling them the truth. Verily, verily, how many times did he say that? Truly, truly, I'm telling you, why don't you pay attention? Now, the house of Jacob was going to suffer for this rejection. Many would be killed, others would be enslaved. The temple was destroyed. If you go up on the Temple Mount today, you see the Dome of the Rock over here, and you see a Muslim mosque over here. That's what there is. There's no trace of the temple at all. And the Jews are not even permitted to pray up there. If you act like you're going to pray up there, the Muslim guards will hustle you away. If you wear a cross up there, they will not let you in. If you carry a Bible up there, they will confiscate it at the door. They got a rack of them where you come in that they've taken away from people. And after this, we see a very brief word of prophecy. He says, "You shall not see me until the time comes when you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" For you, we know that he will return, and we know that he will deal with Israel at that time. So as we ponder this passage, we might ask with a person so very long ago, are there just a few who are being saved? Now to this, the answer is clear. You strive to enter by the narrow gate. Many will seek to enter and not be able. There could have eyes blinded by false doctrine. False doctrine's everywhere out there. We have a culture that glorifies sinful acts. We have government that tends to condone such things. There's false doctrine abroad in the land. It's out there. We know that many are trying to attain the kingdom of heaven by works. I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do this. But we also know no man is justified by works of the law. All you've got to do is read the letters to the churches. But whether few are being saved or many are being saved, the answer from this passage is the same. You strive to enter by the narrow gate. We'll have our closing hymn now.